Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Okay, folks, I think we're going to go ahead and try to get started so we can stay on time, because we've got about 2 hours to do this, but you will see that time is going to fly very quickly in these workshops, because we have a lot of extremely bright, wonderfully articulate people, and I know you have a lot to say on this topic, so we want to try to get moving as soon as we can. That's right. All right. So this workshop is titled Individual versus Societal Rights, Point Counterpoint. And we are going to start things off by having two very brief 10-minute presentations. And then we're going to move into discussions. I see all of you are great at following directions. You're all in your groups. And I will explain a little bit more about what's going to happen within the groups once we hear the first two presentations. But our two presenters are going to basically serve up some information to you and maybe give you a point of view, okay? And then what's going to happen is we have actually assigned each of your groups to discuss and argue and make points for your particular point of view. And because whenever you get, you know, what, if you get two people in the room, you get four opinions, we are also assigning which point of view you're going to take. Okay? So groups A, C, and E, you are going to be the pro-physician side. Okay? The protect the rights of the doctor. Groups B, D, and F, you are going to be on society's and patients' side. Patient safety and advocacy. So keep this in mind as you're listening to our presenters, because we're going to ask you to formulate some opinions and come up with some ideas, and then we're going to choose one of your groups to present your information, and then we'll have a larger group discussion on that particular item. The audience response systems that you have there, we're not going to use until the end. So if you want to put them aside, that's fine, or put them around your neck. But then we have a series of questions. We're going to ask some demographic questions about yourself. Completely anonymous responses, by the way. I want to just mention that. And then we're going to ask you some opinions on where you fall on this issue.
Has it gone through the IRB?
It has gone through the IRB. In fact, it has gone through IRB. And we were told by IRB that we do have a blanket immunity, if you will, because we are completely de-identifying and anonymous responses. So this has been IRB approved. And again, it's going to help us in publishing some of this information from here. So without further ado, I'm going to introduce each of our speakers individually. The first speaker is going to be Jill Silverman. Jill is the president and CEO of the Institute for Medical Quality. The IMQ is a group that is dedicated to improving health across the state of California. They actually run the Joint Commission surveys for the entire state, as well as offering a number of educational programs to help not only individual physicians, but also to help large groups and systems. And Jill is going to be taking the physician advocacy side of things. So without further ado...
Thank you. It's great to be here. And as Dave said, I was given the side of protecting the rights of physicians. I should disclose that's what I do for a living. That's what I've done for a very long time. IMQ is actually a 501c3 subsidiary of the California Medical Association, and it was set up to promote the quality of care by empowering physicians to take an active role in doing that. So the exact position I was asked to present was treating aging physicians in any way different from the younger physician is ageism. Okay. To do that, I thought it might be helpful to start by going back and thinking about what are our common goals before we decide how to get there and which way to get there, what are we trying to accomplish? And I think everyone would agree with this. We want the best access to care for as many people as possible. We want to provide the highest quality care. Studies have shown a strong physician-patient relationship is essential to good quality care. We want to be able to have physicians integrate their subjective and objective expertise, and we want that care to be affordable. Easy wish list, right? We can do all of that without any trouble. So the question is, should we screen physicians? And according to age? No, yes. Let's look at the no. Why should we not screen physicians? Well, their individual autonomy is an invasion of that autonomy. You might get false positives. What do you do with a physician that seems to have no problems in his or her practice, and you get a test that indicates that he or she should be limited? There is a physician shortage. There is no doubt about that. What is the impact on access to care? This morning we saw a lot of statistics about the large number of physicians over age 55, over age 60, over age 65. If we limit what they can do, what does that do to access to care? False security. If you screen physicians at a certain age and they pass the test, does that mean they are competent to provide the care they're providing? Invasion of privacy. Why should physicians be subject to a screen at a particular age? What is magical about that? Liability. Have we thought about what is the liability that you're taking on by screening these physicians? What are you going to do with the findings of that? Is it a yes-no situation? And what is the cost? As we heard from our colleagues in Canada, it's expensive to do appropriate screens. So maybe some of you still think, yes, we should screen. Well, then let's think about what criteria would we use. Is age really the best criteria? We've heard a lot of arguments this morning for a lot of factors that can contribute to problems. I think every one of us has encountered a physician who should not be doing what they're doing at a very young age. There's a reason that some people don't make it through med school or don't make it through residency, where they end their practices very early. So what do we screen for? Are we looking for physical issues? Ailments? Are we looking for mental health issues? Are we looking for cognitive information? Are we looking for performance? And if we know what we're looking for, do we know how to screen for all of those things? And then the big question, who actually can conduct that screening? Do we want to turn this over to the government? Should the medical board be doing the screening? Should the Department of Health Services be doing the screening? Are you going to rely on hospitals to do this screening? And if you do, what are you going to do about the physicians who don't practice in hospitals? Are you going to look at other medical facilities? Are they all comparably equipped to take on that screening? As I said, there's a lot of cost involved. There's a lot of legal considerations, antitrust issues. Are you going to allow physicians to do the screening? If so, how are you going to make sure the physicians doing the screening don't have any personal interest in the outcome of that screening? ADA. What are you going to do to if you have physicians that have disabilities to accommodate those disabilities? And then there's the frequency question. How often should we screen? We heard discussion this morning. I think Dr. Miller said maybe every 5 years isn't frequently enough. Maybe if it's too frequently. And then let's say we're screening and we find this. What do we do with physicians that compensate for their deficiencies? What do you do if you have a physician who has a hearing impairment but uses a stethoscope an amplified stethoscope. Thank you. Is that adequate? How do you build that into the equation? And who determines what is adequate compensation? And then we get back to the physician-patient relationship. Where's the patient's rights in all of this? We all know the story, the Marcus Welby, the patient who loves their physician, who has been their physician since they were a child or has been a family physician for a long time. Do we have a right to go in and say, you know, that physician's not as good as you think he or she is, and take him away, and we're going to assign you to a new physician, or we're going to help you find a new physician? How does that impact that patient's ongoing care? And in general, what is the impact on continuity of care if we're taking physicians out of the workforce at a set age? Okay, we've talked about some of this. Whose responsibility is it? Is this a licensing issue? Is it a privileging issue? And what are the layers of functionality? Is it an all or nothing equation? How do you determine if you identify that a physician may have some level of impairment or some level of limitation? How should you accommodate that? Do you allow a surgeon to go into general practice? Do you allow a physician to move into a different specialty? Should we be talking about limits on licensure? Should physicians be licensed to teach and not treat? Should physicians be licensed to research and not treat? I think the questions go on and on and on, and I think it's hard to answer one without answering many of them. And how would we do all of this? My basic belief is that every age has its distinct advantages and disadvantages. We heard a lot of studies this morning that's talked about the strengths and the advantages that come with aging. We also heard about some of the things that are not as good. We're recognizing as a society as a significant physician shortage. And so I believe physicians can be well qualified at any age, and I think that the task put to you as we go forward is to figure out how we keep those physicians practicing to maximize their contribution and yet assure that the patients are getting appropriate and good care. And how do we address this issue in a way that other than just saying at a certain age, physicians should stop practicing?
Steve.
You should be all set. Actually,
just,
I think you just
don't
can
take it
walk
off.
On off. Yep. We're in good shape here. Okay, so you've now heard one side. You're getting your thoughts and ideas behind that. Again, that is the pro-physician side, groups A, C, and E. You're going to be taking that pro-physician stance, so think about some of your thoughts. Now I'm going to invite up to the lectern here Judge Stephen Adler. Judge Adler is an administrative law judge and has spent a number of years hearing cases that are brought before him on physicians where competency and licensure is at stake. He has a great deal of experience on this. As a judge, he really is not supposed to take sides. He listens to the evidence and then makes decisions. But we're putting him on the spot here. So, and he says, as an attorney, he can take whatever side we give him. He'll defend it to the death. So, without further ado, I'm going to have Judge Adler come up, and he's going to talk about societal's rights and societal's needs, and really looking at patient safety and giving you some information to think about. Let me get the right slides here. There we go. To think about with regards to that. So, groups. B, D, and F, you should be listening in pretty closely.
All right, I have my instructions. I'm supposed to stand here and not move. That's really hard. All right, I guess what I'm supposed to do, I don't want to make sure everybody understands I don't really believe this, but I think what I'm supposed to do is start off by saying something like, it's not the doctor's license, it's our license. It's the state's license, and by golly, nobody should ever forget that. Now, again, I'm not sure I believe that because all licensees have considerable rights in their licenses once they have them, but that's certainly the most extreme position I guess I could take. So those of you who have to argue this side of it, you might want to think about that. I'm just going to run through this. I'm a California lawyer, and I'm uncomfortable talking about any system other than the one I know. So I'm just going to talk about California. I started out and I put together the few statutes in California that might have to do with this. In California. California isn't organized and smart like our Canadian friends are. We don't have a system here that, maybe it can be made to sound as good as theirs, but having used it, I can tell you it isn't. Our system for finding people to do stuff to, of licensees of any sort, is akin to dragging scotch tape through the dirt, things adhere to it randomly. And that's sort of what we do. I mean, the medical board sort of sits around and gets about, last I heard, about 100,000 complaints a year from California's 33 million or 34 million or however many million inhabitants. It runs an inverted funnel. About 400 on average of those cases proceed to formal administrative charges by the Attorney General's office, and the rest of them go someplace else. And that where that goes and why isn't what we're going to talk about here. But there's just a couple of, if we're going to do it by licensing, if we're going to run this based on state licensing and state statutes, I wanted to run through some of the statutes that would apply. Now, being as how I've been a lawyer for way too long, I can only show people statutes in their original format. Fortunately, the folks that run this program quickly saw that my overheads violate the too many words in an overhead rule because I was, of course, quoting statutes word for word because I'm hardwired to do that. So anyway, these are summaries. The first one I want to talk to you about is this section 2229. You've got a bunch of state administrative law judges from the Office of Administrative Hearings in this room. The Attorney General quotes this statute to them every chance the Attorney General gets because it starts out by saying protection of the public by the various licensing entities and the administrative law judges. Protection of the public is the highest priority. Now, the reason that that's important is because the legislature has taken pains to say that re-education, rehabilitation, helping the licensee is a priority, but protection of the public is the highest priority. So if you want to come and play in our sandbox, that's the rule, that protection of the public. The reason for trying to get a lot of these cases dealt with outside of the regulatory licensing sandbox is this. Because if everybody tries to follow this rule, judgment calls are going to go against the licensee. So frankly, the administrative law judges, when I was one and the ones that are here in the room and the others, aren't anywhere near as mechanical as this sounds, nor should they be. But they're certainly going to hear about this from the licensing agency. This is certainly what all the media, when they're writing stories about the bad doctor of the day, they're going to be coming from this standpoint. Now, under 2229, you can aid in the rehabilitation of the licensee. You can impose restrictions on scope of practice as indicated by the evidence. This state doesn't issue limited licenses. If your license is a physician, your license is a physician. Physicians, occasionally there are deals by which physicians agree not to practice in certain areas. But when I was doing this kind of thing, I didn't like those for reasons that we could talk about later. The medical board is supposed to seek out licensees who've demonstrated deficiencies in competency, take actions as indicated that will remove those deficiencies, education, restrictions, or other means. And then we get into the professional competency examination. This is a different section. We used to do this. It really didn't work very well at all. Professional competency examinations, you'd have to find three physicians. You'd have to get their schedule such that they could get together to administer this examination. They'd have to have the same kind of ticket or scope of practice that the person being examined would have. They'd have to agree on the questions. They'd have to agree on what constitutes a right answer, and they'd have to agree on the grades to the answer. Just thinking about this is just an amusing exercise. And I thought it was amusing up until the point where I was given a case in the Attorney General's office of a physician who had failed this, and I was supposed to try it. And that was trying to stick nail jello to a tile wall. It didn't work at all. Anyway, what triggers 2292 examination? What do we do with this now, by the way? 2292, we send them to PACE. I don't know that there's been one of these examinations for years and years and years, but the medical board sends people to PACE for evaluation and remediation. And in my personal, this is not an official position of anybody, in my personal opinion, that's the greatest thing that ever happened. Because I, as a practitioner or an ALJ, I could have some degree of reassurance that if a person went through PACE and PACE said, look, this person has got a big problem, that had some reliability. It wasn't really subjective. They've got a system. I'm sure it's subject to deficiencies, but it's a lot better than just asking three guys or gals to sort of figure out whether this person's competent or not. This is what triggers this kind of thing. Remember how you find out about this is the old Scotch tape through the dirt deal. It has to come to the attention of the medical board in some way. Somebody has to complain, or a hospital reports it, or another practitioner sometimes reports it. But there's no screening going on around here. If there is, it's contractual between a medical group and its employees or something like that. But California doesn't do screening. And if it has, if it does, it started very recently. This is just procedures for how we do this. This is the examination. Like I say, we don't do this anymore. Anyway, I came up with some questions. Assuming that we're screening, of course, we're screening. But we're not screening here in California, so who reports? What's going to trigger reporting, and where's the reporting going to? I mean, these are a lot of the same questions that Jill was bringing up in a sort of a from a different direction. What are the consequences of a report? I mean, what sort of a process are you going to talk about? Are you going to put in place? And whose process should it be? All the processes I've talked about are state law, state regulation, and have as their ultimate consequence action against the professional license of the doctor. But what about other stuff? What about, sort of under-the-radar remediation? Because I know hospitals and other organizations will send people to PACE if they're concerned about them. And that's an under-the-radar thing as far as I'm concerned if I'm in the Attorney General's office or as far as I'm concerned if I'm an ALJ and that case happens to come before me. I'm not going to know about it unless somebody tells me. When does the process become public? I think this is a very important thing for you to consider because there is nothing that will create trouble for a rational system quicker than the perception on the part of the public that secret stuff is going on and licensees are being benefited by their brethren and sistern, if there is such a word, without anybody knowing about it. Because as sure as I'm standing here and you're sitting there, there will be a case where there's some sort of under-the-radar thing that goes on. That person's going to go out the other end of that process, be duly blessed, and some period of time later is going to pop out having done something horrible. Then a spotlight will be shined on this whole thing. So you have to design your under-the-radar system to withstand that kind of thing because there's no such thing as a secret. And if anybody there thinks there is, let me be the first to tell you that ain't the case. And what are the stages of progressive intervention and discipline and who ought to do them? And I don't have any better answers to those questions than any of you do. You probably know the answers better than I do. So I'm done. Thank you for your attention.
Okay, so your tasks now, we're going to have you break off and have discussions. We're going to give you about 30 minutes to work within your groups. And again, groups A, C, and E. We want you to pretend that you're, well, not pretend, we're going to ask you to develop a case that protects the physician's autonomy. You're going to take the side of the doctor that what we're really talking about here is ageism, that it is discriminatory, and that there's got to be other ways that we can possibly do this. Okay? And then you're going to have 30 minutes to do that. I would like each of your groups to nominate one of your members to be the spokesperson for the groups, and we'll ask that you maybe keep some notes of the discussion so that when it comes time to present, you'll have some notes in front of you that you can refer to and really capture the essence of what the group discussed. For groups B, D, and F, we're going to ask that you take the argument of protecting the patient at all costs and that we really need to initiate a screening. There has to be a screening program in place because you have seen data that's been presented to you that says that doctors who are older have more problems. And we want you to be able to defend that. And again, we want you to use your own personal knowledge, your own personal experience, but also for both of the groups to reflect back on some of the information and the data that was presented to you earlier today, because I think we had a nice progression, and it's not an easy issue. But we thought if by forcing people into particular sides, we will really try to ferret out those issues, and when we have the larger group discussion, we'll be able to start to have this back and forth, and maybe, if we're lucky, come up with a little bit of consensus, and we'll try to capture that with the questions that we ask at the end of the session. Okay, so you've got about 30 minutes. We will stop this at about a quarter after. Are we all set? Fantastic. So here's what's going to happen now. Again, we have groups A, C, and E, and B and D combined, so they're kind of a B, D, and F. And so what I'm going to do at this point is I am going to ask for a volunteer from one of the presenters, one of the self-designated presenters from the ACE group, and you're going to come up and you're going to present your side of things. After the one presenter is done, I'm going to ask the other two designated presenters from ACNE to fill in any gaps that might have been left out or add any additional information that hadn't been covered. Okay? Then we're going to hear from the BDF group, and they're going to have their chance to do the same type of thing, present their case, have the other presenter fill in the gaps. And then we're going to hear from our panelists, and then we're going to have some time for rebuttal from the audience. Okay? So we're going to spend the next 40 minutes doing that. So can I have a volunteer? Okay, we've got a volunteer. Come on up. Excellent. So you're going to present from here. And you're going to make your case.
Okay.
And then for the other two groups, the presenters, raise your hand. Okay, be ready to come up because you're going to be coming up after him to fill in any gaps of things that he did not cover that's on your list, okay? Fire away.
All right, thank you.
Introduce yourself.
All right, I'm Daniel Juarez. I'm an administrative law judge with the state here, and I hear medical board cases, among others, but mostly medical board cases. And I'm in the esteemed group E, E for esteemed. All right, here's our list. And this is in no particular order. I'm taking this down as we did it kind of organically, so it's just what it is. We argue that the screening would potentially taint or reduce the stature of the profession. In that vein, we think that physicians have earned the right to self-police themselves, and that having that privilege and right allows physicians who may be more knowledgeable in terms of those factors that affect their practice would have an ability to better assess and analyze those factors and areas that are of concern, where practice might be deficient or skills may be necessary at a certain level. Screening should be focused on deficiencies and problems, not age, because age isn't necessarily the best factor. And the screening should be regardless of age, and this would protect patient safety. And in this vein, we would suggest if they're going to assess, it's not there's a lack of fairness aspect to the focusing on a slice of age in the later age. Age is not the best criteria, or at least we do not know if it is, and there needs to be more research and more data and information to recognize whether age is the appropriate factor as opposed to a myriad of other factors. Experience may be at risk because physicians that are older and have that greater experience, a lot of patients are looking for that type of experience. And by screening out those at a later age, again, an aspect of unfairness plays in, where physicians simply based on their age would be screened when they may have had a full career and a continuing career without any deficiencies or problems. Screening at that age may not be cost-effective. And when you really look at it in terms of the cost-benefit analysis, and because age, we don't have the data to know that that's necessarily the best factor with which to screen physicians, it may not meet the cost-benefit analysis. And it may be cost-prohibitive, surely in California. So in fact, it's really becomes ageism. And in this vein, we suggest that we use what we termed as a softer approach, but really an approach that seeks to enhance the skills of physicians instead of just screening them for deficiencies, and encourage physicians to consider what their skill strengths are, and so that they themselves, through their kind of self-policing privilege and right, could decide to minimize certain practices that require skills that maybe in their later age may not be at their top form. I mentioned that, because it was actually asked of me, whether it was that in the cases that I hear of physicians, whether the majority are older or elderly. And in fact, as I at least thought back on my cases, I don't know how the other judges see this, but I couldn't say that it's mostly elderly. And so there's at least one set of data that we would have to say, I probably have a range of ages of physicians who come in front of me for various disciplinary matters. Lastly, that if we were to look at what we posit to be some of the greater concerns, at least that we have found based on just public information and really my knowledge, at least in disciplinary matters, the issues around substance abuse would probably be a greater and more important factor to focus our limited resources on as opposed to age. And I think that's it. Okay.
All right, so I hope all of you are taking some notes, because we're going to want to have some rebuttal after all of the discussants have had a chance to go. It's going to be kind of like debate club here. All right, so Dick or Merritt? Yeah, Merritt, come on up. And maybe you can fill in some other things that weren't covered by Group E.
Introduce yourself.
Okay, my name is Merritt Matthews. I am a family physician in San Diego, and I'm over 70. So groups A, C, and E, I love you. I think that group C was listening to our group, and so they have many of the things that we discussed. There are some things that are a little different. We decided that screening is already being done in many instances among physicians, hospitals, screen, insurance companies, HMOs, and other organizations like that. Screen the doctors, check their charts to make sure that things are done properly and that certain standards of care are being followed. With the present knowledge that we have, there's no assurance that screening is accurate and can lead to a lot of false positives, and also gives the public false security in the doctors, or may give them bad impressions of good doctors in the community. It will run up healthcare cost with the screening. We want to keep qualified doctors with medical knowledge practicing in the community, so there will be greater access to medical care, and screening will and could possibly impact the continuity of care, which is very important. There's no evidence at the present time to support that screening is effective, there are other risk factors other than age. There's no guarantee that screening will improve medical practice. Last but not least, it will expose doctors in some instances to liabilities and increase the cost of medical malpractice insurance. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Mara. And Dick, come on up and round us off for groups A, C, and E.
Introduce yourself. I'm Dick Christensen, and I'm an internist and medical educator, and do physician assessment for Texas A&M in Wisconsin. To prove the veracity of our group, they also pick somebody over 70. We believe that physicians should not be screened according to age. It's just not fair. And the evidence is weak, as has been pointed out. And we're particularly worried about a false sense of security because it's impossible to screen everybody at the right in the right lengths of time. And so we certainly don't want to give the public information that they could use, not only for litigation, but for their sense of security. We believe that it is okay to screen older physicians if everyone was screened, and that some other criteria were set other than age. And to finalize our argument, we have decided to become residents of California, even the Canadians, and we are going to form a proposition. We think that licenses in California, it's a good place to start out, licenses should be narrowed to the physician's training from their residency and from medical school. And then physicians ought to be allowed then to go on and do other things as they prove that they are competent to do so. So that is going to be the proposition that you're going to all have to vote on in the next election. Thank you.
Is that proposition 70?
I think it's 70 and a half.
All right. Very good. Thank you, Dick. That was excellent. All right. So we've heard from the physician side. Which of the groups? Okay, Joni, you come on up. We're going to hear from the other side.
So, in full disclosure here, I'm a physician, and I'm Joni Baumer. I am the chairman of the Department of Family Medicine at John Peter Smith, a public health network, which is the large public health network in Tarrant County next to Dallas. Rapidly growing, we train more family physicians in our program than any place in the country. So we graduate about 85 residents a year. And I also am the program director for the physician reentry program that we do at GPS, which is a clinical 3-month program for physicians reentering practice after a hiatus for any number of reasons. And I'm a member of the assessment team for the K-STAR assessment team at Texas A&M. And now you're asking me to be the public. So as the public, what I'm going to say in defense of the public is that we feel that to be a physician is not a right, it's a privilege. And that so much like the other rights, also we feel that even though in the United States, healthcare is not a right, it's not a constitutional right as it is in Canada and many other countries, that the public has a right to have safe care. we realize that there's a shortage of physicians, and we realize that the cost of screening for competent physicians is high. However, we do not think that that should exclude doing it. We feel that there needs to be a system in place that ensures the public that some type of screening for physician competence does occur. This is with the full knowledge that there is such systems, but they vary widely, and they vary in effectiveness across the United States. In Texas, for example, we have our county medical societies who do this function. Of course, all of our credentialing committees in our hospitals and our managed care companies do this kind of screening. And then, of course, our licensing board does this kind of screening. However, there isn't any one set of criteria that we could present to the public to say, this is how we ensure that the physicians that are treating you are safe. So we talked about various mechanisms that are occurring currently. We agree with our colleagues that screening by age alone is not necessarily the answer, but that perhaps screening for practice patterns, including development of isolation during a practice pattern, may be more effective and could be used with age. So, for example, if you have a physician whose address changes at the licensing period every 2 years, that those physicians might be more at risk for competency issues. And the suggestion was that perhaps licensing should be done annually as opposed to every 2 years in order to better monitor people who are changing addresses and changing scopes of practice. Finally, we agreed that the board of licensing should work in collaboration with the physician organizations to both train physicians in how to recognize safety issues in other physicians, in how to counsel with those physicians directly, and then if there's no response, how to report to another intervening agency, whether that's a hospital medical executive committee or, in the worst case scenario, a licensing board, but that the patient's safety should always be placed ahead of any of the other concerns for the reporting physician or for the physician in question. Finally, we believe that the licensing board and the physician organization should work together to prepare all physicians to prepare for retirement.
All right. And not just financial preparing for retirement, as we heard. All right. So Dave Balfour, you want to come on up and present for F?
Do you like how I jumped up that stair? My name is David Balfour. I'm an attorney. I practice here in San Diego, and I represent doctors in malpractice cases and before the licensing board. So this is not the usual position for me, but let me advocate for the protection primarily and of highest priority has got to be the protection of the patients. And should we wait until a patient gets harmed before we take steps to discipline or educate or intervene on a doctor's practice? And clearly, the answer shared by every doctor would be no. Nobody wants to have a patient get harmed, least of which are doctors. It's part of their professional pride. It's part of their career, it's part of their education. The patient well-being has got to be paramount. And so on that, we share with the licensing boards, with the governmental agencies, with the other, with the hospitals. Everybody has got a shared purpose there of preventing patient harm. There are legitimate reasons to screen on the basis of age. Mental diseases affect those who are older more than they do those who are younger. And there is evidence that the rates of the onset, for example, of Alzheimer's disease double between the ages of 65 and 70 and continue to increase as the person gets older. They are also, mental diseases are the hardest diseases to spot. They can, and this is in the hospital context or in the group context where you have older physicians, many of them have trained the younger physicians. The younger physicians looked up to them. The younger physicians were very reluctant to express concerns about what they're seeing with their older colleagues. And those types of cultural barriers are exactly why screening is the appropriate remedy. We would disagree with the position that the physicians have earned their right to practice without intervention. We, I think, would speak against the grandfathering and would rather propose that on the basis of age, within, say, the years of age of 55 to 60, and at the physician's choosing, they accomplish three things: physical examination, neurocognitive testing, and a test of medical knowledge. And many of these are already available and are necessary to provide a baseline. There is an idea that there is a diminution of the physician's reputation by having them undergo screening, and that is something that all of us would need to deal with. But there are other examples where such screening is done successfully. For example, the Department of Motor Vehicles screens as a result of age. And they may get flack from some of the older drivers who are out there, but the public outcry is heavily in support of those because of the possible impact of elderly drivers causing accidents that cause harm that could have been avoided. And the same would hold true in medicine. And we heard the examples of the pilots. The pilots, in many ways, are in the same position as physicians. They hold lives in their hands. Physicians hold lives in their hands, and therefore they have a responsibility to undergo such screenings. Thank you.
Okay, and so now I'm actually going to turn it over to our panelists here to comment on what we've heard, and then we're going to open it up to the rest of the group to bounce these ideas back and forth, what you heard that you agree with, what you disagree with. And for those that are sitting in the audience, before you make your comments, we're going to have one of our staff bring a microphone over to you so that we can all hear the comments.
I guess I'm going to go ahead. Is this on? Okay, you can hear me okay. I think that we're hearing some consensus on a few points. I heard both sides agree that patient safety is paramount, that the physician's obligation is to provide good care. I would have to disagree with the last speaker about screening for age. And it's not that I disagree with the concept of screening, but I think the downside of false positives and false negatives outweighs the benefits of screening purely by age. There are so many factors that can contribute to poor outcomes. And as a healthcare society, we've made some progress and we're continuing to make progress towards...
See if I can turn this on here.
Is that not on? Thank you. Towards continuous quality improvement and looking at the care and looking at the care of all of the physicians in the process and putting the resources more and looking at the actual care delivered and then finding where there may be problems, I think is a better use of resources in protecting patient safety than isolating physicians based on age alone, separate from any other indicators. It reminds me, there's one of the physicians on my board who has done a lot of research at UCSF and commented that when all of the health plans started mandating and rating physicians by rates of mammograms and how rapidly they ordered mammograms for their patients, and nobody was arguing that ordering mammograms was a bad thing, but there was a side effect in that a lot of physicians became very sloppy about doing breast exams because they were relying more heavily on the mammograms. And as a breast surgeon, he saw an increasing number of breast cancers from women who had had negative mammograms within 6 months of having the cancer occur. And so it's not that the mammograms were bad, but was that really the best use of looking at that in isolation? And in my mind, it's sort of the same thing. Age is an important indicator, but to isolate age as a screening criteria without taking into consideration the other factors which could impact a physician's competence in providing care may be a huge use of resources that unintentionally takes us away from identifying where the real problems lie.
I'd just like to comment on the idea, and I'll characterize it, and I'll characterize it extremely by this is our sandbox and everybody else should stay the heck out. That ship has sailed. The pieces of legislation that I was pointing out and doing an indifferent job of explaining, the legislatures, they do surgery with bulldozers. So when they are supposed to be in the law, we learn in law school that they're deliberative bodies and that they consider everything very carefully, and then they come up with carefully crafted. That's all nonsense. Something hits the Bee or the Times or the local news show that you can pick, and the little darling starts scurrying around and start pulling out pieces of legislation that will, quote, fix the problem, unquote. And they don't much care what's in it. They just want their uproar to die down, and then they want to be able to say, "Well, we fixed that." Where I'm going with this is, this is an opportunity for people in the business to craft some stuff before the legislature gets its hands on it. I'm in the law biz, and I don't want the legislature fixing this because I've seen how they fix stuff. And they might very well come in and just say, okay, all you folks got to get screened. They probably won't say, we're going to start doing screening routinely, which would make this more legally defensible and probably a better idea and change the culture. So I think that for our counterparts who work for CMA or work in this business of assessing and remediating, this is really a golden opportunity to try and figure out how to do it best and set that up. But when you're setting this up, you've got to think about how is this going to look when the fecal matter hits the fan, because it always will. One of the people that has been through this is going to pop out the other end and get in trouble, and then the fun will start. You just want to be able to not only design a good system, but design a system that will look good when viewed through that glass. Viewed by a whole bunch of people who are going to try and make you look bad, because that's what's going to happen with the journalists and the legislators.
Comments from the audience? Yes. Let's get a microphone.
I think we all agree that we have to do everything that we can to improve physicians' ability to practice good medicine and to protect the patients that we serve. I think everybody agrees with that. And how we do it is very important, how we do it. And I think the judge is right. We have to do something before legislation comes in and starts doing things. And we can do it better. Some of the things are going to be resisted a lot by physicians because that's the way the doctors are. And I think that more of the CMEs that we have, continuing medical education, where we learn about diabetes and hypertension, I think things about aging and also things about screening, et cetera, should be done so that the doctors will sort of get used to this idea and start thinking about what's going to have to be done. And it should be done quickly. I mean, in Canada, they're doing it, and I think that's good. And we should do it, but it's going to probably cost money, and it's going to cause a lot of backlash. But by the time you guys get it done, I'll be retired. So,
yeah, I think we've lived. No matter where you live, you've lived in an area where the legislature has gotten involved with the practice of medicine. And it just never seems to work out correctly. So having heard that, let me throw a couple of other items out there. And I'll speak of what's happening here locally.
We have some, the way San Diego's organized is that there's a number of very large medical groups that take care of most of the lives. We have Kaiser, we have Sharp, we have Scripps, we have UCSD, which is actually a pretty small player in the whole scheme of things. But let me tell you what happens with Southern California Kaiser Permanente here. When one of the partners, and the way it works at Kaiser is you get hired on, and at the two-year mark, you are either allowed into the partnership or they ask you to find another job. So it's kind of a test trial period for the physicians that begin to work there. At the two-year mark, you're then allowed into the partnership, and in the contract that you sign to become a partner is a caveat that at age 65, you are no longer allowed to be a partner. They exclude you from the partnership. Now, that is not saying that you can't practice medicine anymore. They're just excluding folks from the partnership. However, what I will tell you is that some physicians continue to practice medicine, but it's in a different capacity for Kaiser. They may work at an urgent care for Kaiser. They then move to an hourly rate of pay rather than partnership advantages. And so they actually see an incredibly substantial drop in their remuneration for doing similar work. So the incentive to continue working is really not there. Now, is that ageism? Is that a way to do that? One of the other large groups in town, Sharpe Steely, they employ a number of physicians, and their age for being disallowed into the partnership is 70. If you are age 70 and you want to continue on as a physician in the partnership, you're only allowed to do so at the will of the board. So the board actually has to approve and allow you this exception if they want to have you continue on beyond age 70 again. They're not saying you can't practice, et cetera, but these are things that are actually happening in real time around here right now.
What about UCSD?
UCSD does not have that. Question over here, but let's get you a microphone.
I'm just wondering if those have been challenged and tested. We've got an interesting case in British Columbia where a senior equity partner in one of the largest law firms signed a contract like that when he was 37 or something and agreed to step away from partnership at 65. And age 65 arrived, and I don't know if he's the first senior partner in a major law firm that didn't like it. And so he tried to negotiate an out, and his partners declined. So he launched a human rights challenge, and the firm immediately went to court to challenge the basis of his challenge. And the judge ruled that it's a legitimate point. So stay tuned; it'll take years to sort out. But if the legal profession can't agree on whether you can contract away your civil rights, if that's what it amounts to. That's what it sounds like is at issue here. Has it been tested?
I don't know the answer to that, but as of last week when I spoke to one of my colleagues, it's still in place. I don't know that it's been challenged and tested, but my understanding it is a dissolution of a business contract, and therefore it stands. And again, I see some head noddings around, but that was how it was explained to me. Other thoughts, other rebuttals? Yes, Steve. Or Rob, excuse me. Yeah, Rob Steele. Yeah, no, Rob.
there's one other topic from
our
group.
And I'm not 70 yet. I'm pushing 50.
A, yeah. And we were the hesitant about the screening topic, but there was one thing that came up that I thought was interesting, and it kind of depends on the context in which the screening is being done and what the consequences of it are. If it's punitive, we're like, step very carefully. If it's formative and geared more toward enhancing practice, mm-hmm. It was a bit more easier for us to talk about it and even conceive of it being done when we're trying to step into that standpoint. That being said, it was very hard to do this group for me because I'm usually a little bit more of the regulatory eye when I'm doing assessments, but if it could be more formative and protected, kind of like how they do with pilots, it would be a much more acceptable process, I think.
Yes, Dick.
This is a completely different subject, but one of the people mentioned the screening for Alzheimer's disease. And the one thing I can tell you with my years now of experience in assessment is that it can be very, very difficult to do when you talk to somebody, particularly a physician who has a pattern that they have learned. And I have sat and listened to a physician explain all his story to me, and I never picked up that this person had Alzheimer's. But as soon as we started to assess that person, and I can tell you how it happened, because it started with standardized patients, the first thing that we noticed was that he sat down outside the room for much longer than we were used to. And then he went in, and he did a really pretty good job the first time. We were watching, you know, it go on. Did a pretty good job. Then he came out, and, of course, the next patient was ready in the next room, and he had to go right in right away, and he absolutely fell apart. What he had been doing is writing down all his questions ahead of time. And in the interviews, we didn't pick it up, but as soon as he got into an assessment situation, which was formalized, it broke down. So I just want to point out, just as a story, how difficult it can be when you're talking to people. So you really have to watch out with people who are at my age or that are at risk for this disease. No question.
And I believe this came up somewhat during Bill Perry's talk when we were talking about neuropsychological assessments, that physicians in general are pretty smart folks, and we tend to have a very high verbal IQ. And this is one of those crystallized issues in the brain, that the ability to speak, talk, and interact is something that's preserved for a very long time, beyond the point where you start to see pretty significant executive functioning decrements that pop up. And so, excellent point. As you're speaking and talking to someone, doctors are pretty good at fooling folks for a long time, because, again, the verbal IQ starts out pretty high, and you can really maintain a pretty good face for a while. Did I see another hand back here? Yeah. We'll get a microphone over to you.
So I do assessments most of my life. I'm a neuropsychologist, so I test people with Alzheimer's and things like that. And I don't even think you need a physician. You just need anybody who, from many walks of life, that they're really smart, and they found many ways to compensate for their difficulties. So, you know, I'm a big advocate for objective assessment, because, you know, there are times, like, I've only done this now for 6 years, and I kind of test myself, and I go into an office with a patient, and I don't know much about them. And if I really didn't have any background data or without the test, sometimes I still can't figure out whether this person has dementia or not. And I feel like if I'm somebody who does this every day for a living, and I can't do it, I can only imagine other people who try to make that assessment. Because I think what I've learned in this kind of area is that you can never, your eyes really deceive you. So if you think that talking fast and talking articulate is equated with intelligence or memory, it certainly is not. So I think that's, I think a lot of people said that, testing objectively, there's false negatives and false positives. But, you know, I think the benefit of that is that I'm also somebody who doesn't know this person. I don't have a stake in whether they pass the test or not. But that detachment, I think, is also an advantage in making a diagnosis. And so I think that's where the strength of testing comes in.
Tom.
I'd like to piggyback on that with the concept that was put forward from our group was basically baseline data. And it's important that you have that kind of a baseline to deal with what was just said. Even in sports now, people are getting baseline cognitive exams, so they have the data later. Mm-hmm. And I think if you make it a voluntary system, and one thing physicians should understand from their training is baseline data is the basis of all many medical decision-making judgments. So I think that's a really key point of the proposal. The other part was that it's all voluntary, and you have 5 years or whatever you decide it would be to participate. Mm-hmm. And after that, maybe then somebody has to say, why didn't this person submit some information of their own volition about their physical state, about their mental state, and about their medical knowledge? Those things all happen anyway. It's just a matter of putting it together into a system where there are data. Now, the other thing, I wanted to take a little bit of issue with the example of the mammogram as a better way to go, because if you start looking at quality of care indicators, you get into that whole system of confusion, whereas staying away from that and putting it on the physician to demonstrate their own physical well-being is much simpler and much more within the doctor's realm of control.
Okay. Is there anyone from Stanford in this room? So can you talk a little bit about some of the discussions that have been taking place up at Stanford? Are you aware of that?
Well, I think we're trying to establish a program like PACE, I don't know exactly the specifics, but somehow people got really interested in physician competency, and so I was kind of swept up in that kind of fervor, but. We are really at the infancy stage of trying to figure out how to go about this. Right now, we're meeting with administration, like with the dean and with other mucky-mucks, and trying to figure out, how are we going to do this? And our role, the biggest question people have for us is, okay, so you're going to have objective testing. Well, what's the test going to be? And frankly, we're really not sure, because... I think we're coming from the sense that there's not one test that's really going to encapsulate how people are going to do. And the inherent problems with any test is, as you said, false positives, and really with intelligent people, false negatives. That's our concern as a clinician, that the test is not going to be sensitive enough to pick up anything because people are too bright. So some of the tests that are used, like the mini mental, if I were looking at that, I would kind of laugh and because it's not a challenging test for many people. So we're at the stage of just trying to figure out, from other places I've heard, in Texas or in different areas, we just want to know what other people have done. We really are, sort of embryonic at this sense. So we don't know.
Okay. Please. That's what this time's for, is to bounce some of these ideas back and forth.
The very first thing that I would tell you at Stanford is just do it. Don't think about it, just do it. Because the one thing about assessment is that every one of us, when we first start, think we can do it. And the more we learn about it, it's like everything else in life. We get a lot better with it with time. And you start to learn what tests are good and what tests are not good. But you're not any... The worst mistake would be to not go ahead and do it, even though you don't know what tests are, because you're not going to learn from us. What you could do is you could observe us. And come and visit and watch people do it and talk to people who have experience and everything like that. And then you start to get some of what they have learned over years. But you can't look at the literature for this. It just is impossible. But it is very important to do it. There should be 50 centers around the country right now. Should be 100. There shouldn't be a board that doesn't have somebody get assessed that has a question. All those things ought to be done, and there's tremendous, there's full employment in this field. but it should be done, and I think personally that if there are board members here, if they're not getting people assessed, they ought to be very embarrassed, personally. But that's just my opinion. Medical boards that aren't using an assessment system, I think they should be embarrassed, but that just starts out discussion.
We'll go to Henry and then to Laura.
Henry Poland from Albany Medical College. I think there are certain things that are truths. There is an assessment. One assessment is no one tool. And if you look for one tool, everybody's going to make a mistake. And you have to look at competence, and that may mean several tests. It could be multiple choice tests, good standardized patient situations and tests, all done with stimulated chart reviews so that you can get to find out what the person knows. But in order to make an assessment, you have to put it all together. The deficit in America, besides having too few assessment centers, is America has no remediation system. And although there are some groups that are doing some assessment, it's a drop in the bucket to what will be necessary in the future as you look at maintenance of licensure and maintenance of certification, because there will be deficits. And if you look at it from a quality improvement point of view, but opportunities for improvement, there is little effort in the United States to get regional centers or individual centers for that to occur. And doing an assessment without having remediation is probably not the right thing to do either. Many people from different state boards are sent for assessment, and then they're monitored from people who haven't been assessed themselves, who may be equally as bad as the persons that we have seen. So I think that there really needs to be work in that regard. But there is a literature on what you can assess the competency of residents, medical students, and physicians. Much of it has been done in the United States, Canada, and Europe. And I think instead of looking to reinvent the wheel, it would behoove all of us who do assessments to standardize what we do so we can compare it across the country and then push for developing a remediation system.
Laura? My question is, we can say, you know, wouldn't it be nice to do all this assessment and just do it, but I don't quite understand who pays for it. With PACE, the physician pays, or the hospital pays, as I understand it, because those people have already come to the attention, and that may be a good use of resources. We already have such financial problems in the healthcare world now. I mean, I think it's going to end up going the way of Kaiser, with where systems and, you know, where maybe the accountable care organization says, well, to be accountable, we're just going to force people out at a certain age. I just, to be cynical and
sure,
you know. So who pays for this?
Well, one of the things, probably the only economic problem in this country that isn't there is physician salaries.
Oh, I think many physicians would disagree
with you. Well, especially so we can maybe take this one outside.
But it is.
Yeah.
The young. Yeah. No, because, well.
Then if that is a problem, then you should indemnify yourself. In other words, you should get all physicians to pay a certain amount of money at the start of your careers so that you can have somebody.
To be assessed later.
To insure yourself against the fact that somebody might require you to be assessed.
Why don't judges do that?
Well, that's their problem.
I think Penny had a.
Maybe they should.
Penny had a comment over here. And then I'm going to just then get us to the questions, because I want to make sure that we have a chance to go through and get a little bit of consensus, or at least see how folks are answering. Penny.
I'd just like to answer one of the point about who pays and say that in Saskatchewan we have a random screening process, and it's paid for jointly by the College of Physicians and Surgeons of Saskatchewan, who are our licensing body, by the Medical Association, which is the physician representative body, and by the government. They pay one-third each. But my main point was that I heard this morning a lot of angst about the potential false positives and false negatives of a screening process. I think there are just as many risks of false negative and false positive in a system that relies on reporting and on medical error. I see in Saskatchewan we're desperately short of physicians. To have a physician raise questions about the competence of a colleague when it means he's now going to be on call 1 in 2 rather than 1 in 3 is asking a lot. And I'm not at all convinced that, and I hear from my US colleagues, that sometimes competition can produce an unfair emphasis on some false positives. So I would say that screening is a considerably fairer way of assessing a physician's competence than waiting for something to go wrong.
And again, just to pick up on that point, you know, we are talking screening. If we're using the medical model, the screen is not meant to be perfect. The screen is meant to screen. And there might be false positives, there might be false negatives. That's part of what screening is all about. But then you then go on to a more detailed evaluation if, in fact, the screen comes up positive, just like exactly the medical model. So thank you all. That was excellent discussion. I'm going to ask that our facilitators be untethered from their mics so we can get them down and I don't blind them with the slides. And everyone get your little clickers out. So initially, we're gonna get some demographic information from you. And again, I do want to assure you that this is anonymous. We don't know who has what clicker or anything like that. They certainly weren't assigned to you. And then the last few questions are going to be to see kind of where we are with all of this. So, all right. Looks like we have about 35 responses so far. Is anyone left? Okay, 36, 37. Got a few stragglers here. Good. I think it takes a little getting used to. Okay. So we'll close this poll here. There's our numbers. Looks like 62% of you are some type of healthcare professional, the next by the judge, attorney, or other legal professional. Okay. For the physicians in the group or other healthcare professionals, where do you work? All right. Interesting. I wouldn't imagine to have seen so many in private practice, but that's great. And then a quarter of them are in the with the licensing authority. What is your gender? This goes back to everybody again. There's not a third choice there, sorry. Okay, 60-40. What is your age? Interesting. So for the over 70 group, it's only about 5%. The over 65 group is 8%, so we're mostly in the middle ranges. This is interesting. And 13% are under 40. Okay. This is for those that live in the U.S. The Canadian slide is coming up next. What is your geographic area? Three quarters from California or Nevada, and the scattering throughout. For the Canadians. And I have to tell you, I wasn't sure how exactly to group all of the provinces, and this actually came from a governmental website in Canada. So that's what I took. So if you have issue with it, talk to the government. All right, let's hear it. I guess Saskatchewan and Manitoba, right? Okay, so for the physicians in the group again, what best, which category describes your specialty? Wow, A lot of family physicians in primary care, not a lot of specialists. Okay. For the non-physician healthcare providers, which category do you fall under? Okay. For the legal professionals, which category best describes you? A lot of judges in the room. Okay. Are you in clinical practice? Anybody? Any percent time, any clinical practice, any healthcare professional, clinical practice. Okay, 60-40. It's interesting. I thought it might have been a little higher. Okay, now we're going to get to the questions about where we fall on this, and you'll see there's not a lot of detail here, and that is on purpose. So, okay, now go ahead and answer. Interesting. Okay. So if you are one of those yeses or maybes, what age should screening begin? I guess even if you're a no, if you want to just answer this question, go right ahead. Okay. Interesting. Final question. Okay. Excellent. Well, thank you all very much. I appreciate your input here. At this point, if you would just leave your audience response systems in here, it's break time. You may leave your things here because you're going to be coming back to this room. We're just going to flip-flop the speakers, and your next workshop is actually going to be on looking at designing assessments and what should be there and what shouldn't be there.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.